This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
Well, good evening, everybody. I was thinking about things, and felt drawn to speak a little bit about the practice of simplicity in relationship to the precepts and Dharma practice. Thinking about this time when there's so much movement, so much activity, uncertainty, there's a lot of movement. And thinking about the inclination of the mind to accumulate, the Buddha said that the nature of desires is that one is not enough. And one desire that brings something pleasurable wants more. And the situations that we find ourselves in the same way, we build upon in our mind with thoughts and emotions and plans and anticipations and concerns. And it can build and build in our mind and become quite heavy. And what is simplicity? The practice of simplicity. Monastics takes a vow of simplicity, which relates to being without wealth, lifestyle, to live simply. It's common to so many religious traditions, particularly monastic traditions. But what is it at its heart, simplicity? The Latin root of the word is to be frank, to be straightforward, artless, without guile. In other words, very clear, simple, unadorned, to live without contrivance, to live without unnecessary complications, to be straight ahead, direct. And sometimes I think we find it hard to trust that. Simplicity can seem naive, we can think of it as unsophisticated, unworldly, uninteresting. Equate it to being simplistic or boring, somehow without any richness. And yet every meditator discovers that the more simple the mind becomes, the less complicated, the more abundant the world around us becomes. In color and taste and sound. And the Bodhisattva lives a life that is alive. There should be no mistake about that. That is directly engaged, intimately in contact, skillful, so that we can enter into the complications of samsara and people's lives and our own without adding more entanglement. So we can live within a world of confusion without adding more confusion. We can enter into chaos without creating more chaos. So that more and more of our energies goes into actually pure living. Samsara is kind of like an ongoing murder mystery or a detective novel. You know, it's just full of plots and subplots and counterplots, and they're great, right? They pull us in. They keep us turning the page. We want to know what happens next. They're great stories, and they're exhausting. And there is something about our enjoyment of entering into intrigue and all of that. But in the end, it's, is it satisfying? I mean, what happens when you finish one murder mystery is you start another one. One is never enough. And with practice, too, part of what happens is that our own suffering is less and less. I mean, entertaining might seem like an unjust way to characterize our own suffering, as though we're actively entertaining ourselves with it, which is often not fair. Sometimes it might be. But there is something about our suffering that is more than just it being a habit, and more than just it being an aspect of our way we identify ourselves. There's something about it that keeps us engaged. And in that engagement, in a certain sense, we know what to do. We know what the rules of this engagement are. And there's a kind of security in that. So that's something we have to actually have to give up. We have to be willing to give that up. And in doing that, it's happening outside as well, where our entertainment, you know, it's like the precept of not speaking of others' errors and faults or elevating the self and blaming others, that there can be a lot of enjoyment that we get in that and having such conversations about people. And that's ceases. That starts to end. It's no longer enjoyable. Other people's suffering is no longer enjoyable. It's just painful. And it's painful because we see more and more how unnecessary it is, whether it's individual suffering or whether it's suffering on a larger level, systemic suffering, how unnecessary it is. And that makes it more painful. I mean, if it was just the way of the world, if it was just our nature, the world's nature, and we should just shut up and like do the best we can, then, but it's not like that. And it's painful also because it's so real. More real than we'd like. More real than we think is reasonable, and it is. And so Dharma practice, in a way, we can look at it in the precepts in a very definite way as a path to living simply. That they really help us to live in a way that is frank and open and honest and straightforward and without guile. It's just clear. And it's simple enough that sometimes we might be a little naive in our trusting, which is also why wisdom is such an important part of this, is because wisdom has intelligence. And so it's not a naivete that ends up hurting other people, but it's just a willingness to be open and sometimes perhaps to be taken for a ride. All the sources of power that arise in practice need to be grounded, be arising out of wisdom, and also be grounded in the metta practices and compassion, in all of the compassionate virtues that we develop, that we all possess, but that we develop and grow stronger. Because otherwise, those powers, and they're spoken of in many different ways in Buddhism, can become possessions. They can become instruments of misuse. And that happens all the time. And sometimes it's actually a spiritual power that a person is developing. And sometimes it's the power that comes with a position or role. And bodhicitta is what helps to ground that and to, in a sense, temper that or keep that simple, keep that straight ahead. the selfless motivation for the liberation of all. And so every time we're chanting the four vows and we chant, all sentient beings are numberless, I vow to save them. That we take in the magnitude of that, but also the particularness of that. People, individuals. In every number that we're hearing when we read the news these days, this number sick, this number tested, this number in ICU, this number dead, these are people. Whole lives. And that grounds us. It makes the numbers not numbers. And so, bodhicitta, the four immeasurables, are really necessary practices, and urgently so, because they help ensure that our motivation is going to remain simple. Right? When it becomes self-centered, it's not simple. In a sense, that's part of what makes compassion so compelling and so challenging, is its simplicity. Situations are not always simple. People are certainly not simple. But in a certain sense, compassion itself is. It's just not harming. I've been reading a teaching by Nagarjuna, a treatise on provisions for enlightenment. It's also titled A Guide to a Bodhisattva Path. And in it, he speaks about these spiritual powers or abilities. And these are often attributed to the Buddha or an enlightened being, the heavenly ear, the heavenly eye, the basis of spiritual powers, being able to have cognition of others' thoughts and cognition of past lives. He said one should cultivate purification of these five spiritual abilities. The commentary says that these powers are not in and of themselves particularly useful. Or desirable even, unless they're counterbalanced, they're infused with wisdom. Because they possess an inherent or a strong karmic inclination to be used or misused. And so that's why the Four Immeasurables, bodhicitta, metta practices, generosity, paramita are all so important. And he says these four bases of spiritual powers that is part of these spiritual abilities comprise the root. So the four bases of spiritual powers comprise the root of these spiritual abilities. And they are zeal and vigor, mental focus, and contemplative reflection. The four immeasurables govern these four bases. And they are kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And so these four bases of zeal and vigor, mental focus and contemplative reflection, we might think about these qualities, these attributes that we all have, these forces, you might call them, and that we all possess them. And sometimes they're very weak, they're not very well developed, or they're just hard to access, and sometimes they can be very strong. And these all work together. Zeal without mental focus can become wild, can come a kind of an affliction, actually, a kind of excitement that is not a good use of our energy. And so zeal is, and these come up in other descriptions of who you are, of what it is to practice and what it is we're cultivating. And zeal often comes up because clearly it takes an enthusiasm to practice, right? I mean, one of the most difficult things in practice is when we're sort of ensconced within apathy and indifference and a kind of sluggishness. Very difficult. Zeal is an incredible force, a power, a spirit, enthusiasm, a kind of uplift within that we can cultivate. It's like a life force. And it's infectious, you know. When others have it, we feel it, and it helps to pick us up. That's part of what we do within a Sangha, is we offer that to each other, sometimes even unwittingly. Sometimes that's the best way. And how we think, and how we speak, and how we act. And in training, and the rigors of training, the vigor of training, we develop the capacity to bring forth this zeal, this enthusiasm, when it's slight, when it's dampened. In other words, we learn how to draw forth. It's like learning how to wake yourself up in Zazen when you're feeling sleepy. Same thing. It's really a very similar kind of process, where you're drawing deep from within yourself, and that you begin to discover that actually just simple things like how you hold your body, this body mudra, what you're doing with your eyes, so importantly, what you're doing with your mind. That as you bring all of that into focus, maybe you reflect on the impermanence of things. Maybe you remember why practice is important to you, what your aspiration is. And then you draw forth that spirit, that enthusiasm, and it drops off. It dissolves that sleepiness, and the mind becomes very clear and sharp and with spirit. It's very powerful. And we begin to learn how to tap into that, how to find that, and how to turn that sluggishness, which is such a strong inclination within us, keep turning that and turning that. And we learn how to do that off the cushion. And not be so reliant on the feelings that we might have in a particular moment. The feelings of energy, the feelings of emotion. We begin to learn how to work more and more with this whole complex. And so to think about these qualities at this time and how important they are, when we're in the midst of a sustained crisis, a sustained emergency, where there's a continuation, a continuum of difficult things to face, of difficult information, difficult news, difficult things to take in. It's very easy just to become weary. And it's, in a sense, natural to become weary because it takes a lot of energy to hold all of that. And that's part of what we can be working with and learning how to work with that. And that's what these bases of spiritual power are about. Vigor is the effort, an effort that is very focused. It's right effort. It's skillful. And none of these are fixed. So this vigor sometimes can be strong when strength is needed. We can bring that forth. And there's so many times when we're needed, you know, when we're called in simple ways that happen in training all the time, in big ways. And we may not feel ready, we may not feel like we're the right one, we may feel like we don't have it at that moment, but we're being called. And so this vigor sometimes is strength when strength is needed. And there's a kind of... blending of inner and outer, that the situation is calling that from us, and we call it from within ourselves, and we're able to bring that forth. And sometimes vigor is gentle when gentleness is needed. It's like infusing our intention with confidence and with zeal. An important part of vigor also is that it may be very clearly focused and directed towards something, but it's without attachment to result, to outcome. Mental focus, of course, is one of our most powerful forces, perhaps the most powerful force in our human world. Our attention, our mindfulness, our concentration, samadhi, our ability to bring our attention to one place. And of course, every living creature has that. Without that, there would be no survival. But for human beings, it has very special qualities. that we can't know until we begin to experience them. And that's why the teachings are so important. When we encounter these teachings of these masters who have gone so deep within themselves, within their meditation, within the very same meditation that we're doing, and they speak of these different experiences and realms and capacities, they're speaking about that for us, right? They already know. Right? They're not doing it for themselves. They're doing it so we can know. And we can recognize, well, if they have that within ourselves, we have to have that within ourselves because we're not different. And then contemplative reflection also. Extraordinary power that we have, the ability to reflect. And of course, so much of the time we're practicing trying to free ourselves of all of the non-contemplative, non-reflective mental activity that we're engaging in. Where there isn't mindfulness, there isn't attention, a focus, a mental focus. There's just a lot of activity with, you know, longer or shorter periods of focus that then break up again. But contemplative reflection is very particular, and it's based in mental focus, and it's based in intention, and it's directed towards something that is worthy of your reflection. The most essential things to examine, to see clearly, to understand it deeper and deeper, in deeper and deeper ways, so that our life comes out of that, is within that. And this is part of training, is learning how to have to engage this contemplative reflection in ways that isn't just thinking. It's very simple. At the same time that it can be contemplating or reflecting on something that is of the utmost depth, it's the simplicity that allows that to happen. It's like the merging of samadhi with a deep inquiry beyond ideas and concepts, which in the beginning of practice can just seem like, what could that possibly be? How can we inquire within awareness without the vehicle of an idea or concept? But our meditation shows us that, begins to help us discover that. We can think of the precepts as requiring these bases of spiritual power. Spirit, zeal, vigor, focus, reflection, examining, understanding more and more karma, what karma is, so we can work well within it. In a sense, put it to work for us, for each other. When we take refuge, when we atone, when we forgive, all of these are very powerful practices. You know, we can think of forgiveness as such a sort of common usage in our language, such a common sort of parlance. You know, we encountered it as children. Forgive your sister. Ask for forgiveness. I mean, what an incredibly powerful force to bring forth atonement. I mean, without atonement, we'd be crushed. Atonement is what allows us to live simply and directly. And atonement itself is, in essence, also simple. Sometimes it's hard to get to that place of simplicity where we can actually atone. It's like sometimes it takes so much work to work through that which seems so complicated to get to that very most simple act of releasing. And in all of the complex relationships we have with each other, with children, with jobs, workers, bosses, with all of the world, people in the world we have conversations with every day that we'll never meet, politicians, presidents. Everything we do requires life force. And Nagarjuna says that the four immeasurables govern, guide, hold, help us to keep clear these most powerful forces that we have. In a sense, all of these engagements, these atonement and forgiveness, taking refuge, mental focus, if you look at any of these and just look at their opposite, their opposites are samsara, are our suffering, are all of the things that bind us and drag us down and make life not only complicated, but unpleasant, impoverished. And so the four immeasurables are, you know, in a sense, bringing us to that very simple impulse, which, you know, often we see in children. You know, there's a story recently of this four-year-old girl in, was it Pennsylvania, New Jersey, who got lost in the woods, chasing her dog, or chasing after a ball or something, just in her backyard, got lost in the woods, 4 years old. She was gone for 3 days, 2 nights. And when they found her, she was quite happy, couldn't wait to tell her mom about all her adventures. And I remember reading a book on being in survival situations, and the author said that in his research he discovered that very often the smallest children do best because they're not very complicated. They don't get caught up in a lot of future thinking and a lot of, you know, they're willing to crawl under a log and get dirty to keep warm, right? It's very, very simple what needs to be done. She was, oh yeah, she was found. I said that, right? And so the immeasurables of this very simple desire to want every person, every creature, every thing, animate or inanimate, to have its own happiness, whatever that means. Whatever that means to a mountain, whatever it means to a tree or a stone, whatever it means to a cloud, to have its own life of happiness and without suffering, and to delight in its world and its world in relationship to its all of the things of its world, whatever those relationships are like. We can't fathom that. We don't need to, but we do need to grant all things, these immeasurables, that they live in equanimity, that they be able to live simply, that a cloud can live just as a cloud, a tree can live just as a tree, fulfill its nature without unnecessary complications. And when we all of our energy is directed to that, what better thing could we do and be doing? Tis the gift to be simple. Tis the gift to be free. Tis the gift to come down where we ought to be. And when we find ourselves in the place just right, it will be in the valley of love and delight, the valley of compassion and joyfulness. Tis the gift to be simple. That we give that to ourselves, we give that to each other. And to not be afraid of that.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.org.